Right. So obviously, you know, have yourself good food. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. So yeah, the abstract mentions that's Clement the Alexandrian. Why I don't call him Clement of Alexandria? I mean, in my traditional mind, there's a distinction between a bishop, the bishop of a certain place, you know, which would be like Clement of Rome, you know, and someone that wasn't a bishop but lived for a while in Alexandria. In this case, Clement the Alexandrian. So I know sometimes people get confused about my way of addressing these matters, but there you go. It's a traditional viewpoint, an ecclesial designation. Yeah. So I'm not Doru of Bucharest, I'm Doru from Bucharest. So, Stefan. And
when you become a bishop, then you'll be.
yes. The first married bishop of Bucharest after millennia.
Yeah.
What I try to do is, first of all, it's useful to me. In 2015, I was granted a sabbatical, and I managed to write quite a fair bit on Clement's contemplation of nature. But being caught up with other things after the end of 2015, I couldn't do anything. So this is my way of returning to that topic. Actually, I've written like 50,000 words, and I have plenty more notes to use for the completion of this project, but that's how things go. Sometimes you have to do other things, and honestly, this is the second time I address the topic of my book in the last week or so. I presented Friday in Lambert at ACU, I presented a broader outline of the book, but today I focus on a given topic. And the idea is to look at how Clement construes the process of nature contemplation. And also to look at his perhaps most obvious paradigm, scriptural paradigm, the profile of Abraham, the patriarch, a figure which in Clement fits the bill of what Clement called the holy Gnostic, the saintly contemplative, you could call it. And without further delay, let's jump into the topic. First of all, a few minor things about Clement. We don't know anything with any certainty, anyway, about his biography, or at least his early biography. We just assume that he was from Athens. There's some indication that he lived at least for a while in Athens, and there he went through the whole curriculum of education. At the time, Athens possessed the best school in the whole of the Roman Empire. For some reason, he seems to have left Athens, obviously after graduation. And he went on a quest, if you want to call it that. Maybe it's a philosophical quest, a spiritual quest. His story somehow replicates that of Justin Martyr. St. Justin was from Palestine. He went to a number of schools in order to find the best philosophy. He presents in his dialogue with Trypho, the Jew. He presents this quest, and he shows how disappointed he was in his search. Why? Because he found a number of excellent teachers, but there was something that they shared in common, a major fault, namely there was a rift between their words and their lives. Justin embraced what he called Christian philosophy because he found a Christian teacher whose words gave expression to his life, and his life was backing up his teaching. In other words, it's something like searching for the classical philosopher in whose experience teaching and life go hand in hand, the way Pierre Hadot portrayed the classical philosopher, what is ancient philosophy, philosophy as a way of life, and other books. Plotinus, for instance, the beautiful biography of Plotinus. Pierre Hadot tried to show how classical philosophy was not about building systems using fancy terminology. Those were the outskirts of theology, philosophy. Clement seems to have been involved in a similar quest. His journey brought him to Alexandria in Egypt, place of interaction, cultural, philosophical, religious, spiritual. And there he met what he calls somewhere the Sicilian bee. So a man from Sicily, very likely a Greek from Sicily, southern Italy was very Hellenized at the time. Pantanus by his name. By the way, he's a saint of the church, Pantanus. Not much survives, if anything, of his authentic writings. He was more of a Socratic figure. Pantanus was not only a Christian teacher, but he was also a philosopher and a teacher of philosophy. He was running at the time a school of Christian philosophy in Alexandria. I'm certain very much like the school of St. Justin in Rome. Justin never presented or introduced himself as a Christian theologian, just said that he was a teacher of Christian philosophy. So there was this institution of independent Christian philosophers. They did a lot of service to the church in the early centuries, mainly because, what the narrative was, Christians are stupid, Christianity is a religion for slaves, widows, and I don't know what other categories. These Christian philosophers did a tremendous missionary work in behalf and on behalf of the church by showing that Christianity can also be educated, refined, satisfying the aspirations of the intellectuals of the time. Converted to Christianity under Pantanus's guidance in Alexandria. Sorry, that should be an in Alexandria. He established his own school of Christian philosophy. Now, in the 4th century, Eusebius of Caesarea, the ecclesiastical historian, claimed that Clement was also a priest and a catechist of the Church of Alexandria. Apart from oral traditions, there isn't any direct evidence that he was a priest and a catechist of the Church. Nevertheless, there is a homily preserved from Clement, a homily on that passage in Matthew, about the salvation of rich people. How will they don't remember the exact words, sorry.
The eye of the needle, is that the one?
Hmm?
The eye of the needle, the camel.
Yeah, that one. So yeah, the it's difficult to be saved. So how will they be saved, the fact that he pronounced the homily that was transcribed maybe by his scribes or something, you know, may indicate the fact that he was a catechist in the church and therefore maybe a clergyman. But as I said, that's from my viewpoint the only indication that he was involved in that capacity in the church. Otherwise, like any other Christian of the time, I'm certain that he would be always a participant in the divine liturgy and communion in all things with his co-religionists. But what is certain is that he was a teacher of Christian philosophy, much like Justin Martyr and Patens before. He left a number of works. The best known works are, it's actually a trilogy, Exhortation, the Tutor, and Miscellany, so various things. In reality, this title doesn't render exactly what he meant by his stromatis, that's the title of the book. Stromatis is like the threads that, when woven together, become a nice, colorful carpet where there's usually an image, you know. So that's the title of the book. The Latin Sand and Miscellanies just points out the variety of topics discussed there. Of course, it's a multi-volume book. Well, the scholars still debate whether or not the eighth book is authentic, but there you go, there's a huge volume of writing involved there. Anyway, this trilogy is of course associated with other writings, and in my presentation I'll refer to a writing that is part of what Clement himself designated as superior or higher knowledge, higher teaching, under the title of Didaskalos, the teacher. So he made a difference between the tutor being the pedagogue, so pedagogos, that's the title of the book in Greek. The other one, Didaskalos, the teacher, where Christ and his gospel are presented for the advanced in the faith. The point being, Clement, as a teacher and maybe a catechist, would always apply pedagogical criteria in his teaching. He was an adherent to what the Greeks called paideia or paideia, which entailed training and also formation. Formation for life, or training for life, if you like. It wasn't just a matter of getting some skills, becoming a lawyer, for instance, or I don't know what else, an engineer or something. No, you would go through the entire curriculum, but at the same time, your life would be transformed. So that was a very holistic kind of understanding education, not just, you know, becoming, not just career-driven, you know, kind of pedagogy, but life-driven or life-oriented pedagogy. As a teacher, Clement applied a number of pedagogical devices, observed pedagogical criteria, which undertaken was facilitated particularly because of two main features of the culture of that time. On the one hand, there was the ecclesial initiation, and in the early church, these three categories, catechumen, baptized, and advanced, were clearly delineated. This wasn't just something that the Gnostics or the Gnostic movements innovated. No. Throughout the spectrum, including in mainstream Christianity, there was this distinction between someone that is a beginner in the faith, that learns the fundamentals, someone that being baptized receives a further initiation or further clarification in respect to faith, and then the advanced, those that went beyond the preliminary teaching and started to make sense of things and apply that understanding to their own life. You have something similar, for instance, already suggested in the letter to the Hebrews in the New Testament, where I think it should be like chapter 3 or 4, I don't remember now, where the author, assuming it's St. Paul or one of his disciples, would say, well, you have heard of baptisms and the cross and all that, you know, now let's get to the meat of it. So there was this idea of an advancement. Faith isn't, wasn't for them, for the early Christians, something that was given once and for all, or something that you would embrace once and for all, and nothing happened. You had to grapple with your faith to make sense of it, to develop it, to mature in the faith, and so on and so forth, to the extent that your entire life would become like a true Christian philosopher. Your entire life would become an embodied preaching of your faith. But it was something similar, I mean, this kind of gradation, this process of initiation or becoming was also part of the Platonic curriculum with three stages, ethics or transformation of life by undertaking the path of virtue, physics, which is what interests me in this book, namely natural contemplation, the contemplation of the cosmos, and epoptics, which is the highest vision or the divine vision. Things are, of course, quite complex. I'm not doing justice in any way to what Plemmer has to say about these things, but that's that. What's interesting is the fact that the similarity between the three-stage process of initiation that happened in the church and the Platonic curriculum allowed him to implement the Platonic curriculum on a very wide scale throughout the spectrum of his thinking, musings. And this is just an example from Miscellanies, the first book, chapter 28, where he tries to make sense of Moses as a philosopher. You know, and although he identified four parts in Mosaic philosophy, he pointed out the fact that this corresponded to, without saying, well, there's a reference to Plato there, but without saying that this is actually his way, that is Clement's way of interpreting Moses in the light of the Platonic curriculum, he actually presented the four chapters as three stages according to the Platonic curriculum. So he says Moses' philosophy is divided into four parts: the historical one, the one properly referred to as legislative, both pertaining to ethical subjects. Then the third is the liturgical one, which corresponds to natural contemplation. I always have a problem with this, you know, I still haven't grappled sufficiently with this thing. How liturgical matters correspond to natural contemplation, to physics. Okay? And the fourth, above all, the domain of theology or the epoptic, which according to Plato is about the great mysteries of existence, and which domain Aristotle designates as coming after the natural things. Metaphysics, yeah? that's just a sample, that just to illustrate how Clement applied the Platonic curriculum, you know, to a variety of topics in his teaching, including by presenting the Old Testament, the wisdom of Moses, as he calls it, you know, as compatible with that of Plato. In reality, throughout this tremendous book, Miscellanies, he actually said, well, it's Plato that got inspired by Moses after the Old Testament was translated into Greek in the 3rd century BC. The Greeks had a chance to look at the Pentateuch at least, and they learned from Moses, so they robbed us of our wisdom somehow. Now we take it back. That's how he presented things. Now, what's very interesting in Clement, and that's my main interest, is the fact that he did not use the Platonic triadic pattern, the Platonic three-stage pattern, in a servile way. He developed it. My interest, and actually my book is about this thing, this second stage of physics, which isn't well treated in scholarship. The closest that I could find was actually very interesting. So I had my sabbatical in 2015, second semester, roughly at the same time, an Italian guy published what seems to have been his master's thesis on creator and creation in Clement, a guy, Matteo Monfrinotti. I browsed the book. Thank God he didn't see how important this was. So, there's something very significant there. That's about it. Not many other people have noticed how significant the second stage of physics is in Clement. Why I point this out is the fact that Clement is usually considered a typical Platonist who would quickly fly away from visible things, from the universe, would go up to embrace the angels, travel together with the angels to God, his contemplation of the cosmos or cosmic order and beauty would be only a stepping stone. It's not what I found in Clement, and the fact that he referred, like in the previous passage, he referred a number of times to Aristotle is very significant. Aristotle was far from evading from reality. Aristotle was far from soaring aloft towards the invisible. Aristotle wanted to make sense of this world. And the fact that Clement referred to Aristotle quite a number of times, and actually most of his physics is Aristotelian, not necessarily Platonic, although there are some Platonic overtones there, but actually undertones, but it's mainly an Aristotelian science. Tells heaps about his actual orientation. So he wasn't into evading from this world. You know, most scholars would look at the early Christians, you know, suspecting them of being too much in love with God to love this world that God has created for them. Anyway, Clement has developed the second stage of the Platonic curriculum, physics, by including another triadic pattern. So physics, or the contemplation of nature in Clement, becomes a triple stage, if you like, or a triple process itself, where there's first a description of the universe, phenomena and all that, which requires scientific expertise. This is where his Aristotelian muscle is flexed. Then interpretation, this is where Clement shows his Christianity, because he interprets that scientific worldview, that Aristotelian worldview, he interprets that from the vantage point of theological criteria, the doctrine of creation, for instance, a scripturally based doctrine of creation. And unfortunately, I don't have this passage with me, but there's actually a couple of passages where he says, in order to make sense of the universe, according to the canon of our tradition, the rule of our tradition, we need to begin with the discourse on cosmogony. That's how he calls Genesis. Yeah? So he looks at an otherwise scientifically described world through the lens of a theological mindset rooted in the doctrine of creation, inspired by the scriptures, particularly Genesis. In this second stage of interpretation, he actually refers to a number of ecclesial themes. He represents the cosmos, its harmony, its unity, its coherence. He represents that as another church. There are many voices within the universe. The universe sometimes is likened to an orchestra. All things in the universe have voices, or if that's the choral analogy, or all things in the universe are like instruments in an orchestra, and who is the choir master? It's the Logos Christ, who has created and saved everything, bringing all things to harmony. I brought here, not just because it's a nice cover, a book, Alexandrian Legacy, A Critical Appraisal, which I co-edited with some former friends. And there's a chapter that I've written, Worldview and Melodic Imagery in a number of early Christian authors, including Clement. So it's Worldview and Melodic Imagery in the Alexandrian Tradition and Certain Patristic Antecedents. There are some details if you'd be interested. This is available on my Academia A2U account. The chapter on Clement is, the section on Clement is, useful to make sense of how theological and how ecclesial, to some extent liturgical, was his interpretation of reality. So the first stage of Clement's physics referred to a rigorous description of reality according to the science that was available at the time. The second stage was his attempt at making sense of things the way a Christian mind would look at things. And the last one, vision, so description, interpretation, vision, is more like the province of someone who is in touch with God and can make sense of reality the way God does. This, of course, entails the experience of deification or holiness. Yeah? These are a few examples of Clementine physics. For instance, in relation to the description of reality, there's a number of passages there, but there's many more available. For instance, one of the things that someone that approaches analytically the universe discovers that reality is unity and diversity. Everywhere in the universe, there's different things, but all these different things are consistent with one another. So the first idea that one gets when looks at things is how different all things are. But on the other hand, one discovers that there's an underlying order which binds together all these things. An example of interpretation which brings us back to the topic of his liturgical mindset. Reality perceived as song and doxology through the lens of scripture. And this is actually what he says in one of those treatises that are part of his higher teaching, prophetic selections, ecloge, prophetice. Right at the beginning, first chapter, he speaks of the book of Psalms, of the book of Daniel, and some other Old Testament wisdom book. And he says that if we look at reality through the lens of what those books, but even the Psalms, disclose, we see how everything is song and doxology and all things point to God. You know, famous psalm, you know, the heavens tell the glory of God and stuff like that. Vision, well, that's something that actually is the most difficult part of what he says, because you must trust him if you are not one like him able to see that. In other words, if you aren't a saint, you can't actually check that out. It's you can't make sense intellectually of that kind of experience. Let me take the back door. I don't know if I mentioned this last time I talked here
or the previous night. Anyway, in Adovnan's Life of St. Columba, there's a reference to an experience to St. Columba. It was an ecstatic experience, and Columba was able to see the whole of the universe unified as a single ray of the sun. That was a beautiful metaphor, single ray of the sun. That was the divine bird's eye view, which you cannot acquire. You can be Stephen Hawking or whomever you like, but you cannot acquire that kind of vision. That's a complete grasp of reality through the eyes of God. In order to do that, you have to be God-like. In other words, deified, utterly transformed. And the example given here from Miscellanies, book 6, chapter 8, and the next chapter 9, refers to how a saint in fellowship with Christ has access to the entire knowledge of Christ. I assume this is a process. It doesn't come in like an instant download. It will crack, I assume, if that happens. But it's a gradual apprehension, if you like, of what Christ discloses, to the extent that such a person has a grasp of reality that Christ has, the Supreme Teacher, which means to make sense of how things have been, are, and will be. What they have been, what they are, what they will be. Yeah. So it's a comprehensive grasp of reality which doesn't fit in the fit the bill of any kind of cumulative outcome of research. Yeah. Maybe at the end of time, physicists will be able to grasp this, but until then, there are shortcuts, it seems, and without let's put it that way, a supernatural experience, that kind of grasp of reality is out of question. But this brings us to the topic of the Holy Gnostic. This is the central topic of Clement's teaching in Miscellanies. I've given you only two examples, whatever passages there were, where he speaks about the Holy Gnostic. That's his expression. The Holy Gnostic is someone that is a sage, a Christian sage, but more so a saintly person. That person can be he or she. Clement was very adamant. Really, I'm not paying here tribute to our customs today. He pointed out the fact that gender is irrelevant here. Yeah, it can be a he, it can be a she. This is an experience that is available to all in Christ. So the Holy Gnostic should be saintly, educated, and deified. Saintliness or holiness, of course, corresponds to Platonic ethics. See, even in the representation of a Christian saint, Clement still returned to the Platonic education, his own Platonic formation, and he pointed out the fact that in the experience of a Christian sage, of a saintly sage, you can recognize the same ideals that were shared by Plato and his disciples, only, of course, achieved in a way that maybe Plato himself could not even think about. So, the saintly person corresponds to the stage of ethics and the fulfillment of ethical formation, very educated, therefore knowledgeable and being able to make sense of phenomena and stuff like that, and also deified, able to grasp reality through a divine kind of sight. That's a supernatural experience from my viewpoint of intents and purposes. Moving to the second part about Abraham. Abraham was one of the scriptural illustrations of the Holy Gnostic. Among the Holy Gnostics, Clement mentioned the martyrs, the apostles, Moses, and Abraham. I assume he left room for prophets too, but he was particularly fond of Abraham, in whose journey he recognized the trajectory of a holy Gnostic from education to holiness. And this is what he says in the fifth book of Miscellanies about Abraham. Initially, the patriarch was called Abram, you know, it's from Genesis, which means, that's what Clement says, and I cannot check it because I have no knowledge of Hebrew, elevated father. In Greek, it's patir meteoros. A father whose mind is lost in the clouds. he says elevated father. For being interested in the lofty philosophy of the atmospheric occurrences and celestial movements of the astronomical phenomena. Afterwards, however, on looking up to heaven, so he kept gazing, upwards. On looking up to heaven, he saw either the sun in the spirit, son of God, that is, as some interpret the events, or a glorious angel, or he recognized God in some other way as superior to the whole of creation's order. For this reason, he received another alpha, letter A, in his name, which signifies the knowledge of the one and only God. So he was called Abraham, becoming a sage and a lover of God instead of a natural scientist. It's mind-blowing, you know, what he does. Of course, there's this thing with from Abram to Abraham, you know, the difference of an A, the second A, or Alpha, as he says, which corresponds to what? The first number in many ancient alphabets, including Greek. Aleph is also the first number in the Hebrew, whatever.
Aleph bet.
Yeah. It's the first letter of the alphabet, but also the first number. It means one. It means one. And one, according to Clement, is the number of God. Yeah? So he discovered God, and therefore, to signify the fact that he discovered God, he got another Aleph, another Alpha, which shows that he no longer was the father whose mind was lost in the clouds of meteorology or whatever he says, the astronomy. Whose mind gazed upon the divine. Yeah. So, and what Clement describes is this trajectory from astronomy to theology. And of course, astronomy seems to be a preparatory study that leads to theology, so that the more one looks up, the more one can increase his or her chances to see God in the order and the beauty of the creation. And what's interesting, as he says in the same book 6 of Miscellanies, chapter 10, even after discovering God, the interest one had initially in astronomy should not diminish. He or she should keep staring at the heavens and keep trying to make sense of things. So theology never supersedes science. That's for me mind-blowing, because we have so many issues in our day and age with science and theology, which is which, who's who, who's the queen, who's the slave, and so on and so forth. And I'm certain that even though Clement gave absolute priority to theology, as in seeing God, he would never forget about everything else. For which reason he wrote so much about the the universe, and also he paid so much attention to ethics. He wrote an entire huge book, the Tutor, the Pedagogue, on how to, for instance, raise children, have a family life according to Christ, and so on and so forth. Why would he pay attention to these tiny, insignificant things if his mind was only about leaving this world towards meeting his God? And I think this is my last example, which is an application of the concepts of natural contemplation to an episode in the history of Abraham. Perhaps remember after I think it's the first encounter between Abraham and God, or when Abraham listens to God for the first time, he gets this commandment to travel to a certain mountain. We assume it's Mount Moriah, which I certain has nothing to do with Lord of the Rings. There he was supposed to sacrifice his son, Isaac. And according to Genesis chapter 22, the first few verses there, they traveled, Abraham, Isaac, and a couple of the servants, traveled for 3 days or so, and in the third day, they saw the mountain in the distance. And this is where Clement inserts his interpretation. So he interprets the 3 days. The first day represents the sight of beautiful things in nature. Okay, so one travels, and instead of looking at the iPad or the iPhone, one looks around, you know, sky, clouds, trees, birds, and all that, you know. That's the first encounter with the world. The second signifies the soul's desire of improvement. Wow. How did he get to that one? It's not obvious in the text, but I assume that he shared in the wisdom tradition of both Greeks and Jews before, believing that what we see in the world around us contains lessons for life. An admirer, or indirect rather, admirer of Clement, St. Basil the Great in the 4th century, in his homilies on the days of creation, the Exaimeron, applied abundantly the same methodology. He would describe natural phenomena, including animal and plant behavior, why some trees grow higher than others, and so on and so forth. And he would draw from those examples lessons for life. Yeah, so something similar must have clicked in Clement's mind. The third day corresponds to the mind discerning the spiritual things, for the eyes of understanding had been opened by the teacher that resurrected in the third day. A reference to a prophecy. So the third day of the journey already sends the entire story, projects the entire story in the New Testament, Christ resurrected from the dead, Christ being the teacher. So there's no other reference to Christ, the teacher, didaskalos, from whom the highest and most secure teaching about everything comes. Yeah. And then again some reference to Plato. It was only normal for him to have seen the place from a distance, since the location of God is inaccessible. That place of which Plato learned from Moses, as encompassing all things and the universe, and which he called the space of the forms, horaton ideon, space of the forms, the divine eternal ideas. This is like an exercise of natural contemplation, taken as a pretext, the story of Abraham. Of course, it's what you would call allegorical or spiritual interpretation of the text, so there's nothing historical about this interpretation of Abraham's journey, but at least we can see how consistent Clement was in the Miscellanies, throughout the Miscellanies, in trying to articulate natural contemplation according to the Platonic canon, but also under the guise of scriptural interpretation this time. For him, scripture and Platonism were not so far away from one another. Well, so I'm, you know, there's some observations about the previous passage. So first it's realizing the beauty of the cosmos. This lifts up the mind, or the soul, as he says, to desiring improvement. So that's the ethical formation. And finally, the last stage, which corresponds to the teaching of Christ, resurrected, discerning the invisible or spiritual side of reality. These are the three stages of the curriculum, but the first two are somehow reversed. Yeah. typically, Plato would begin with ethics, to continue with physics, and then epoptics, the highest vision. In this passage, we have the first two stages reversed, and this is another Aristotelian stance. In Aristotle, there's again a triadic pattern, and in Aristotle, it all begins with science, with physics, and then one moves to ethical formation. So we have here Aristotle creeping in the narrative without, you know, damaging too much the context. To draw some conclusions, what we learn from Clement that there's an inextricable link between spiritual journey, spiritual formation, transformation, and the knowledge of things around us. What Clement presents is not a saint whose mind and desire is fully or wholly focused elsewhere. Even though Clement's saint is able to experience supremely the divine embrace, Clement's saint is also very much in love with this world and tries to make sense of it, to make it livable, to bring to the fore what's worthwhile in this world, which is something very important for us to learn how to do, of course. In summary, purification and virtue for him are catalysts for knowledge. This is where Clement would disagree with contemporary science, with its objectivism. For him, the more one progresses in purification and virtuous life, the more one's perception enlarges and can see better with or without the aid of the sciences. The more spiritual one gets, the more interested one is in making sense of God's creation. So a Clementine saint would never forget about God's creation. And this entails an interdisciplinary bridge of scientific expertise and theology. Remember the figure of Abraham, an astronomer who has become a theologian without ceasing to be what he originally was, that is, an astronomer. And, well, just by way of information, if you want broader context to this problematic, you can access my Academia interview account, where I uploaded the summary of the talk I gave last week at ACU, and actually the audio recording of that talk. That'll be, I guess, helpful for whomever is interested in this kind of exotic stuff. That's it.
Thank you. That was very interesting. Since this is your third talk, as you said, to me it seems like, you know, the third part of the series, because this kind of topic of, you know, faith and reason and, you know, science and theology is, I think, present in a lot of your work. So it really, I suppose, comes down to the question of the relationship between faith and reason after all, in all those authors that you looked at, because you looked at Athanasius the other day,
mm-hmm.
at Clement today. Who was the third?
The first one was actually a survey of the book that I'm still struggling to finish. I'm at the conclusions now. Early Christian Representations of Reality, and that's where I actually I have mentioned Clement, but in larger company, that of Ignatius, Irenaeus, Athanasius, and the Cappadocians.
Yeah. Do we have any questions or feedback to give to Doro?
The
F word.
I tried as well, but stop me, so I think
I'm not an academic or nowhere near that, so, but just taking a very lay sort of perspective on this, is I'm getting the feeling that it's a natural contemplation of nature. It's not messing with nature in essence. And it seems like in the modern day, where the conflict seems to be occurring is where science tends to manipulate nature, whether it be through, you know, modern science techniques, whether it be through reproductive or techniques, that sort of, it seems to me the conflict, whereas I'm getting the understanding here from Clement is that it's more about appreciating nature and then learning from that. That's the science of contemplation rather than the science of manipulation. Creating something from nature that's, you know, influenced by man, whether it be genetics or I don't know, you know, as an example, maybe IVF clinics, for example. But I'm against it or for it. I'm just making the distinction here that I'm understanding that it's more contemplating what's natural rather than what using science to, you know, make something unnatural.
That's a very interesting point. Thank you. We usually forget the fact that at least when we think environmentally, for instance, to stick to grounds that are more familiar to me than IVF and other ethical, bioethical dilemmas, it's. It's the sciences, or rather their technological application, that have caused the crisis that we are facing, we are experiencing, you know, the degradation of the environment, the exploitation of so-called resources without any regard for habitats and all that, you know. We have poisoned the world, actually, you know. And that's mainly due to the advancement of Well, let's call it techno-science, you know? A technology that applies the sciences. I mean, the sciences themselves, I don't think should be suspected as destructive or something, but the way we manipulate our technology, that is definitely destructive, because we are corrupted by power. Yeah, that's it. The power that technology gives us corrupts us. Yeah, see, I mean, yours was a very important point. Thank you once again. Environmentalism, for instance, could see theology or this kind of natural contemplation, as Clement suggests that we do it. Environmentalists could see this as an ally, because someone that gets an idea of how things hold together. Remember the exercise that he proposed at some point. So first you see diversity, but then you see how all things hold together, unity.
That's what I was thinking through the whole talk, reading it, saying it. You know, the symphony and that, how ecosystems are interconnected and interdependent. And I thought that's just, it's so environmentalist in its thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, you cannot avoid, you know, for instance, drawing some lessons for today. I think I barely touched, you know, the topic, you know, a couple of times, but not much more than that. But it's there, and I believe that at least from an environmental viewpoint, natural contemplation is very useful. It's also very useful, and that's where we get closer to Clement's heart. It's useful on a personal level. I mean, he did believe in the need for the human being to progress, to better itself. Remember, you look at the beauty of things and you desire improvement. And for him, opening one's eyes to the beauty of God's creation, the order, the harmony that characterizes God's creation, one becomes richer. We have diminished our experience. We have limited our experience to, what our careers determine us to do. You know, we focus on this and that. And we usually lose the context. And most of the things that you hear in, for instance, economy or politics and all that, it's all about immediate interests, narrow-mindedness, and never, you know, you don't see in the current discourse the bigger picture. Where do we fit in? Where do our aspirations fit in? And I was reading a couple of months ago an article in, I think it was in Nature, or one of the journals. We are an oncogenic species. We cause cancer to the world, and that's meant literally. Even animal species, bird species, plants that we touch or come more often in touch with us suffer because of this, and I mean literally, genetically, they are changed, altered. I don't want to play here the environmentalist card, but I believe that all these are connected, you know. So how can you be a good environmentalist without having this richer view of things and richer experience of yourself in the midst of everything else? They are all connected. And yeah, so that's of course a different topic. Why don't we refer more often to Clement in terms of science and theology? That's really a stupidity, but this just shows that at least in many Christian quarters, we don't dare to look at early Christian theologians in order to draw wisdom. And from this viewpoint, it's like a slap on our faces, at least people that live and work in so-called traditional churches. We keep talking about tradition and the church fathers and that, but no one reads those. And what we find there is such an inspiring, such an enriching worldview.
I also found the symphony comment, that was the one that most interested me, and the phrase that reality is unity and diversity. So that sort of symphonic relationship or the harmonious relationship. I was thinking about that in relation to nature itself. It can't be at war with itself. Nature is a perfect system. Our theological understandings also can't be at war with themselves. They're perfect systems. But then you want the same relationship between our theological and our scientific understandings. And that I think that was the point of your talk. But then it also applies to our contemplation of reality, that we contemplate, but we don't want to stand at a distance. We want to embrace reality in that same type of the same type of harmonious relationship. So we try to interact with nature in such a way that it improves us, but also we improve nature. So the city, I think, should be a marriage of the natural world and the human environment. rather than destruction, as
you mentioned. Yeah, definitely. This is the big difference between modern culture and traditional cultures. Even when technologies were advanced, like in major civilizations of antiquity, you know, they were very technologically advanced. I mean, not even to this day we can make sense of how they built those citadels in the Andes, you know, like Machu Picchu and so on, Sacsayhuaman, where they haven't used mortar. Mortar? Eh?
Yeah.
Okay. But those blocks of stone are so perfectly fit, to the extent that after hundreds of years or millennia, you know, those walls are still up, and we have no idea why. Or the Roman roads, you know, Via Appia is still, you can still drive on Via Appia, you know. You give me any M4 or M2 in not 10-20 years.
5 years.
Yeah. So they were very technologically advanced, but because they had this sense of belonging in the world, you know, they have operated in a way that did not lead to the utter destruction of the environment. We have lost that wisdom, and you know, this should not come as a surprise. Modernity is, by definition, an anti-traditional culture. We don't need wisdom. We just need the inquiry. Okay, fine, good. But why wasting what was achieved beforehand? See, no wonder that, you know, this has repercussions in the entire society, in our lives. We don't connect things. We go to church, play the good Christians, and then we behave in very different ways, opposite or just parallel. But why parallel? Why don't we bridge all these aspects of our experience? This is what the ancients have discovered, and I think Clement's natural contemplation is a way of bringing together, you know, the experience of holiness. So nothing of that verticality that is required, I mean, as in vertical upwards orientation, required by the experience of the divine, is taken out of the equation. It's there. But the more the Clementine holy person scores in that respect, the more that person gets a better understanding and positioning within the world.
Thank you. We don't really have much more time to go, so thanks again, Doro, for your
Thank you.
Presentation. And shortly about Armenia.